The Tom Woods Show, episode 1606.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Come on now, folks. If you ain't going to start that side hustle now, then when? Check out my free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income, where I take you step by step through five things that I do that keep food on the Woods household table and how you can do them too. Check it out at pathstoincome.com. Everybody, Tom Woods here. Before I get to the last episode of Bob Murphy Week, let me remind you about something that I'm pretty happy with. Of course, as the year goes on and we get closer to the election, we're going to hear more and more and more so-called progressive talking points about a variety of issues. And you've got to be ready to smack these down because so many people are falling for them. And yeah, you may think, sure, I can answer these things, but do you really have all the facts and figures at your fingertips? Probably not, because most normal people don't, because they're busy making a living. Well, my living is precisely that of providing you with this information so that you can be an effective debater and you can understand the world better, frankly. So I actually have an ebook that I'm very happy with called AOC is Wrong, The Upside-Down World of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Does not cost you a thing. And of course, all these arguments can equally well apply to things that Bernie Sanders says because they're the same issues and they're the same positions on those issues. And it just goes through point after point after point. Whatever the issue is, there's a chapter on it and it's just smashed. So check that out at AOCisWrong.com. I mean, this is the book you've been waiting for and now I got it for you. All right, so Bob and I are going to wrap up Bob Murphy Week with yet more difficult topics. So we're going to go from everything from animal rights to what do we do about the poor and one or two other questions along those lines. And then I want to say a little something about a topic that Bob and I have had some interest in, and that is anarcho-communism, you know, where you have anarchists who also don't like private property. So how do we handle that particular position? So we're going to zip through a bunch of topics today and wrap up Bob Murphy Week. Bob, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, here it is, the last one. We're going to do a lightning round here. We're going to do maybe 5 to 6 minutes per question. Okay, and some of these are tough questions. So you got to just give us the basic outline. Let's start with something that is important to a lot of people, animal rights, whether animals have rights. Now, Rothbard doesn't think they have rights. That doesn't mean that human beings ought not to treat animals humanely. But that's different from saying that animals have enforceable rights. I think Rothbard's view is that animals are kind of, either they're nature-given resources or they're property or whatever, but they are not rights-bearing entities. So, Bob, what is your view of animal rights? And secondly, in Kapistan, if somebody's torturing a dog, is there really nothing we can do about it?
Okay, so this is another area where back in episode one when you said where weaknesses or whatever. Yeah, I would love to read, Tom, somebody who fleshes this out in a way that eases our squeamishness. Cause yeah, we all kind of know, yeah, someone just torturing dogs. Ugh, that's gross.
Yeah.
I don't want that to be able to just happen with impunity, but on the other hand, it can't be just some ad hoc. Well, that's illegal cause I don't like it. So to go through this, I don't think animals have rights in the same way humans do. And this, I suppose, is a problem. Like, it depends, well, where do you think rights come from or what's the mechanism or the process by which we figure out what our rights are? So I think you and I, Tom, are, you know, fans of Thomas Aquinas, and obviously we're Christian and come out of that view. And so the fact that Jesus ate meat, for example, is why I'm okay with being a meat eater, because it's kind of, okay, well, Jesus did that. And so I'm assuming that can't be something that's, you know, completely perverse. That doesn't mean like factory farming and stuff is okay. And maybe, you know, that's something that I should look into more for my own consumer choices and supporting things that I think are good. With a lot of this stuff. So again, it might sound like a cop out, but I'm going to say in terms of, let's just make sure that, you know, the worst case scenarios get minimized, the homeowners association. So yeah, if you see somebody either on their front lawn or you hear about them doing, oh yeah, this guy, he has his buddies come over every Friday night and they have dog fights in the basement and, the, you know, they're to the death and whatever. It's really, Well, that might be against the policies, just like you can't have an ugly car with rust accumulating on your front lawn. So again, that kind of stuff gets rid of a lot of these problems. But if the answer, you know, if the question really is, you know, point blank, is it illegal to cause harm to an animal? I am not sure what legal principle you would use to end up there, or to put it another way, I'm not sure who would have standing to sue, because I don't think it would be illegal in a free society to kill a chicken in order to make chicken nuggets. And so I think it's kind of hard to then say, well, okay, but, you know, doing something else. And maybe there's a level of the rationality. Like, obviously, I think people feel worse about torturing a chimpanzee versus swatting a mosquito. And so, you know, there's something there about, you know, whether it's they're closer to us or just that they're more intelligent. It seems like maybe they're more capable of experiencing pain. So I don't really have a great answer on that one. So maybe I'll be honest with the listeners and say I would love, like I say, Tom, for someone to show me, using standard libertarian principles, the portion of the law that could be brought to bear here.
Yeah.
But I think it would be tricky, you know, because it had to be something like you can't cause needless suffering to at least a certain type of creature that's not human. And that sounds like a moral principle for sure, but I don't know, again, because I don't think animals do have rights per se. By the way, last thing I'll say is, if it turned, you know, it wouldn't stun me if 200 years in the future, chimpanzees or something did have more legal rights, you know, because they are, you know, I've seen videos of, like, they have really good memory, short-term memory and stuff, like faster than humans. And so, you know, I could see, I mean, maybe the legal system eventually does recognize that, you know, these creatures are almost like us, and maybe they do have quasi-rights or something. That wouldn't stun me, but in terms of just, you know, in general, do animals have rights the same way humans do? I don't think so.
All right. Now, I appreciate your frankness on this. I have this sense that maybe Gary Chartier has done something on this. Maybe I'll ask him about that. All right, let's move on to another one. Now, this one's very broad, but it's an objection I get a lot. And, you know, I would be lying if I didn't admit that, you know, sometimes even I worry about this. And that's the issue of poor people and things like healthcare. If there were no state, can we feel certain that these people would be cared for? Because that's the thing that I think a lot of people do legitimately worry about. Like, these are not would-be tyrants. These are not terrible people. They just cannot imagine an institutional arrangement whereby these types of services for these types of vulnerable people can be guaranteed. So what can you say in reassurance?
Well, it's funny how you phrase that. Is you said something like, well, a lot of people are worried about, right. And so that's why we can be sure that society wouldn't just turn its back on the poor in a free society. Because again, in other words, it's sort of like, well, everybody knows they wouldn't want to live in a disgusting world where the poor were ignored. And so that's why everyone agrees to form a state and to, you know, pay their taxes quite happily to fund food stamps. I was like, okay, so you just showed then that it's all voluntary. You know, if, I don't know if you get what I'm saying, Tom, but it's sort of like I don't mean the, you know, the reasonable libertarian who's just very concerned. I'm saying like this typical supporter of the state who thinks libertarians are crazy. They would typically try to say that the coercion is not involved when it comes to, quote, forcing people to pay taxes to pay for food stamps and Medicaid and stuff like that. They would say, no, most people agree with that, except, you know, cynical, heartless SOBs like you libertarians. And so, okay, then, if you don't need to be forced to do it, then it would work in a free society, right? So there's that element, too, that it's they're kind of stuck if they're going to try to argue that all these private philanthropic solutions wouldn't be enough, then at least they are admitting that, yeah, we're going to point guns at people to make them give more than they want to. And I think a lot of them would shy away from actually admitting that. Having said all that, but a lot, keep in mind, too, for any given level of technology and resource availability and blah, 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 this state makes people way poorer than they otherwise would be. So the problem of poverty is greatly exacerbated by all kinds of things the state does, not having to do with income redistribution. So, for example, I mean, the healthcare system, and I should say, Tom, like, that has really struck home for me as I've been, you know, dealing with family members who have medical issues and, like, going to the ER and just sitting there till 2 o'clock in the morning and going out and periodically checking. And then the people on staff don't even know what I'm talking about. And I was like, you told us an hour ago you were going to do such and such. And now you don't even know. You know what I mean? Like, it's insane in these hospitals. So I see how people feel like this system isn't working. And if they're told by, you know, some Republican, oh, this is free market and healthcare, and don't trust Bernie Sanders because he's going to give you socialized medicine. I could see why people, well, then give me socialized medicine because this system's crazy. So I get all that. But of course, Tom, I would say that no, the reason the current healthcare system in the United States is so perverse is it's not being run like a business. It's because of all the government intervention and the fact that the patient is just this nuisance, and you're, because the bill's actually being paid either by the government or insurance company. The patient is just this nuisance that they're trying to get rid of. They're not the customer. So I think, you know, fixing healthcare more along free market lines, you know, getting rid of the FDA, medical licensure, and so forth, that would bring down medical expenses. So it would no longer be the case that, oh, gee, you gotta have a 9-to-5 job in a major corporation or else healthcare is unaffordable to you unless you have the government there. That wouldn't be a thing. Healthcare would be very accessible. You know, minimum wage laws make it hard for people with low skills to get in the workforce. Government schools are terrible. They don't give you any skills. And you might, you know, depending on where you are, you could be physically assaulted in them. So that would all obviously be much better. The drug war causes all kinds of crime and poverty, and especially in disadvantaged neighborhoods and stuff like that. So a lot of the baseline of people thinking how poor everybody is, or the large segments of poverty, that stuff is so much exacerbated by all the things the government does already, that in a free society, the problem we'd be trying to deal with would be much smaller. And the other thing too is just charity on the ground is much more wisely administered. That, you know, like a church or something that's running a soup kitchen, they're not going to let people starve. I mean, the church that I go to in Evanston in Illinois, that, you know, we went and we have like a homeless outreach and stuff, so that, you know, they're not going to just let people literally die on the street. But on the other hand, it's also, you know, they're trying to rehabilitate people too. Like, they, to them, a success story is not another number on the list so that they can get more budget funding next cycle. It's that, oh yeah, Jim was coming here and then we finally got him cleaned up off drugs and now he's got a job somewhere. That's great. Good for him.
All right. One more of these. And then actually, I think we're going to shift gears because I have a bigger picture question that I
think. So when you call this a lightning round, it wasn't really a lightning storm. It was just like a one shot.
Well, it's good. Three of them would be lightning round. By Bob Murphy standards, 5 or 6 minutes is a lightning round. Okay. So we're.
No, but I'm talking about the frequency of the bolts. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I'm calling an audible because I think for the last one we'll allow ourselves a little bit more time. But this one, school shootings,
I'm against.
What is it? Just arm the teachers? I mean, what is the answer here?
Well, as a pacifist, that can't be my full answer, can it? So
right. So yeah, so yeah. Okay. So what's the Murphy answer?
Well, you ever see the scene in the Matrix when Neo's dodging? I think the kids need to work on the flexible lower back. No, that's a joke. So, I mean, of course, just to make sure some of your listeners don't misunderstand, although I'm a pacifist, I understand most people are not. And certainly, if any of our modern societies became Rothbardian next Thursday, there would be lots of private guns in use. And I wouldn't have a problem with it. You know what I mean? I might just say, well, you just think about the benefits of blah, blah, blah. But certainly that's not going to offend me or anything like that. So let me just make sure I clarify. So, yes, I think if we went to Rothbard land next week, the immediate response is, especially for schools that thought they were possibly vulnerable, that, yeah, they might have a couple. They probably, I don't think they would arm the teachers. I think it would make more sense. They would hire, you know, some people to come in as extra security. But, you know, the idea of, did you have this guy on your show, Tom? I can't remember, saying for teachers who already, you know, are trained in firearms safety and blah, 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 just to let them start carrying, and that would be an immediate way.
It might have been Larry Correa who said that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, okay. I mean, that when I heard that guy's pitch, that made a lot of sense to me in terms of, okay, right now, practically speaking, what could you do? So, I mean, there's that stuff also. But, I mean, it's, you could do, there's ways you could try to minimize who can come into the schools. And, you know, I don't want to, I haven't done a lot of research on this. My understanding, though, Tom, is that it's, in the vast majority of these cases, it is a government school and not a private school where these shootings happen. Do you know if that's true or not?
I think it's overwhelmingly true. In fact, I don't know if the statistic is right, but I've heard that it's never happened in a private school. Could that possibly be right?
I've heard that too, but again, I feel, you know, I don't want to say that and someone's like, you idiots are so.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah, I'm afraid of the angry responses we're going
to
get.
Right, because I've noticed that you try to just say things on Twitter just to make sure no one gets upset at you, Tom. That's a joke, folks. So given that, I mean, it sounds like, to the extent that that's true, it must be that the different policies, or I don't know if it's because the kids are involved or, you know what I mean, the private schools can be more selective. So I don't know enough about it to say, if I were running a school, this is what I would do, because I'm not going to be running a school since there's a lot of stuff I don't know that you would need to know to be able to properly run a school. But I'm saying, given that pattern that both of us seem to think is true, it must be the case that there's policies the individual schools can have in place. And I don't merely think it's, oh yeah, the private schools right now all have teachers who are armed, and that's why would-be school shooters know not to mess at those schools. So I would say that as well. So whatever it is that right now is making it so school shootings isn't really that much of a thing at private schools, all the schools would be private in Rothbard land. And so there's that element as well. I mean, so in the limit, if you wanted to say, no, but give us more concrete. All right, well, I mean, they could build safe rooms and stuff like that so that, if there's, you know, the alarm goes off and everyone runs in this room and it's locked and so forth and it's bulletproof. I mean, you could do stuff like that and it'd be a fantastically wealthy society if it were free in the sense of that Rothbard means the term. So that wouldn't be hard to do as just a supplemental thing.
Okay, fair enough. Now, let's get to a particularly juicy one. I did an episode on this a while ago, but it's a while ago. And I'll link to that episode at tomwoods.com/1606. And that has to do with anarcho-communism, right? These are people who say that they are anarchists. And I believe they had the word first, fair enough. And yet we look at them and say, but the things you want to do, you would need a state for. So are you really anarchist? But they're not so easily dispensed with. They have a completely different view of the rights and wrongs surrounding property. And also it could be, I think you would also wind up arguing with them about things like, at what point can we say a property has been abandoned? If I own some estate and I just don't ever use it, I think their view would be that maybe I'm wrong, Bob, that a squatter might eventually be able to claim it because it's basically fallen out of use, things like that. I could be wrong about that last point. But what is their point of view, and what would be your answer, even if it might not convince them?
Okay, sure. So in grad school, I really tried to debate and sort of build bridges with the the other thing too is I'm trying to remember and I can't, because a socialist and a communist aren't interchangeable. And so I think there are people that call themselves anarcho-socialists, but they're not anarcho-communists. And just like among libertarians, Tom, you know, if someone said, oh yeah, libertarian like Tom Woods and Tom Palmer, those are two libertarians, right? And you would say, well, I'm not like him. So likewise with among the leftist versions, they have their own individual sex and whatever. And an outsider who comes and says, it's a bunch of commies. Like they would get really upset and say, no, we have very fine distinctions among us and they're the fakes and we're the real communists and blah, blah, blah. So there's all that stuff. So stipulating ahead of time that I'm probably going to say things that the expert over there would think is fuzzy. What I found when I was debating those people, Tom, is I didn't beat them on their own terms, right? So it's not, don't misunderstand, it's not that I thought I lost the debate, but I could see why we sort of came to an impasse and I couldn't show that there was a contradiction in the way they were looking. So a lot of times when I debate people, whether or not they endorse what I just thought, like I'll think, oh yeah, I just blew that guy up. Like I just showed how he contradicted himself. And whereas with these people, it kind of came to a standstill. And the problem was ultimately the definition of legitimate property rights. And so what I noticed is the arguments that I would use, for example, to explain why it was okay, like, oh yeah, a guy owns a bunch of apple trees and there's a hungry person outside his property, the way I would describe it. And it's illegal for the person to hop the fence and come and take the apples. And the way the anarcho-communist would say, oh, and so you're going to use violence, you're going to shoot that guy. And I would say, well, no, actually, I'm a pacifist, but certainly it's illegal. And I think it would be fine if this person had security escort the person and physically remove him from the property. And there's nothing wrong with that. And they would say that's illegitimate. And the arguments they used and the arguments that I was forced to use to defend it, we ended up sounding like libertarians complaining about the state. Like, say, why should I have to pay taxes? And, you know, otherwise they're going to put me in a cage or they're going to kick me, you know. And so for a, you know, like a Bill O'Reilly fan to say, what are you talking about? These are the rules. And if you don't like it, you can leave. Like, I was forced to end up saying that, like, hey, these are the rules. And if you don't want to pay for that apple, then get off the land because it's not, you know what I mean? Like, so we ended up, it was really just a matter of, well, the reason it's okay for the person who owns the apple trees to behave that way is because he really does own it. He's the just owner. The reason the mayor of the city can't say, if you don't pay your property taxes, we're removing you from your house, is because he's not really the owner. The mayor's not the owner of that piece of land. The homeowner is, right? So ultimately, we weren't disagreeing in most of the principles. It was just we were disagreeing about who's the rightful owner of stuff.
So is the problem then? Yeah, that's just it. I mean, when you have a debate that really fundamentally goes back to first principles, you know, that can be very tricky. I kind of like the way, frankly, Hans Hoppe approaches this kind of thing, where he says, and maybe you'll know what the ANCOM response to this is, that what we're dealing with in society is the problem of too many wants and too few resources. Because, you know, in principle, there's no end to the things that I could want to use. I could maybe, you know, I would be very happy to have 24 houses and maids to keep them all clean. But the problem is there aren't 24 houses that I can have. So how are we going to come up with a peaceful resolution to this problem? And the answer is we need to have some way of assigning clearly property rights to individual people so that instead of having violent outbreaks over the use of different pieces of property, we'll have a system whereby everybody recognizes, you know, that such and such is the owner of a particular piece of property. So what would this look like? Well, it can't be the system that we decide upon, can't be verbal declaration, because then we'll all declare that we own a particular kind of property. There has to be some approach that clearly marks it out as belonging to one person rather than another, which is why I think the first use or homesteading kind of principle is the best approach, because it is something we can all see. It's something that we can all apply that. Whereas if we were all just shouting at the same time, that wouldn't resolve anything. We wouldn't, you know. So in other words, he's coming up with a way of justifying the anarcho-capitalist starting point on the grounds that any other approach is arbitrary and leads to conflict. So I don't know if they have an answer to that. I'm sure they must.
I'm trying to remember, because again, it's been a while, but I mean, they have to have. So let me also just mention, when I was admitting, oh, I didn't beat them, my analysis of property rights and incentives and the problems with doing such and such obviously was much more robust than theirs was. All right. As somebody who was getting a PhD in economics and who had studied the socialist calculation debate and all that stuff, obviously, I think I had thought through these things way more than they had. I'm just saying I couldn't literally pin them down in a contradiction. It was more that they could just keep falling back on certain things where, again, Tom, we disagreed on fundamental premises and we couldn't push it back that far. So, you know, when somebody would say to them things like, okay, well, who decides how many cars get built? Or so like somebody, in, what are you going to, and they would, oh, well, the community of workers at the factory would decide. And then you try to get more, okay, so the factory, you know, the owner, the workers that are effectively own the factory in your model, what happens if half the workers decide to sell their decision-making rights to the other half? You know, like half of them realize, you know, I don't really know that much about cars. If you were willing to give me a bunch of apples, I would say, you know, you can have my vote. Or if you prefer, I'll vote however you tell me to, if you just give me an apple every day. And so I would say things like, is that, are you going to allow that? Is that okay? And, you know, they was, because really what they don't like is large-scale accumulation of property. So they're okay with, or at least the typical person, they have no problem with, you know, the carpenter owning a saw and a hammer and stuff. It's just the idea of one guy owning 16 factories strikes them as repugnant and just crazy. Like, how could anybody believe that? You know, all the workers are the ones making the stuff in the factories day to day, and some guy who lives in, you know, Boca Raton is the one who owns everything and makes all the decisions. That's crazy. You know, the workers should. So again, I would try to back them into a corner by saying, well, you know, given, okay, let's say it starts out the workers own everything, what happens if these one-off transactions, or likewise, you know, their objection to interest payments, you know, because they thought that was exploitation and whatnot. So again, I would start from first. Okay, you just said carpenters can own saws and hammers and stuff. So what if one carpenter right now says to a guy who's an up-and-coming carpenter who doesn't have a hammer yet, I'll give you my hammer right now, but next year you give me back a hammer and 10 screws. Is that okay? Can he do that? You know, that kind of stuff. And, oh, you just allowed for interest in a sense. Is that okay? You know, so I'm not, they didn't have a great answer, I don't think, to that stuff. But again, it was never that I could totally pin them down exactly, because ultimately what they thought of as legitimate property titles was different from what we did. And so that was really their objection, that what right does a guy have to, you know, you can't own 16 apple trees and then stop a homeless guy from coming and eating an apple if he's starving, because they didn't think you had the right to own that. And it was tricky to answer your question, trying to get them to say, okay, but somebody must determine who gets to eat the apples. Because as you say, Tom, you know, there's not enough apples to go around. So there has to be some way that society makes that decision. And isn't that a form of property? And the last thing I'll say is some of these people were very sharp. So I don't want to make it sound like they were morons or something. I mean, the people, like, I would much rather argue with an anarcho-communist than the typical John McCain supporter.
Yeah. It'd be much more interesting.
Right. John McCain support probably, in terms of policy views, is closer to me. But still, yeah, is someone who's a John McCain supporter as opposed to, you know, something more extreme on either end of the spectrum is probably not that deep of a thinker and hasn't read too much political philosophy.
Are there any consequentialist arguments you can make against their approach? Because the first principle stuff is hard to crack through with them on. But is there a way you could say that society is going to be worse if the understanding of property is, goes according to your preference?
Well, there's certainly, I mean, yeah, I can make the argument, but they, you know, I didn't convince them, if that's what you're saying. So it's not that I thought I lost. And, oh, gee, maybe now it's an open question. Maybe anarcho-communism is a good idea. That's not what I'm saying, but it's just if I'm making claims. So, for example, probably a lot of Misesians would say, oh, they're for, how could you possibly be for communism? Didn't you read, don't you know, Mises showed that 1920 socialism doesn't work? And they're very familiar, the educated ones, they're very familiar. Like the websites I would go to, they would have whole, like an FAQ on anarcho-communism or socialism. I forget what it was. You know, point number Roman numeral 8 was Ludwig von Mises' calculation argument. And they would have a whole section as to why that didn't blow them up. So I don't remember, to be honest with you, off the top of my head what they said. But they were very aware of his argument, and they would go and quote from the leading intellectual socialist who thought he gave some, you know, it wasn't like Lange and Lerner. It was something, you know, more recent than that as to how they would try to deal with it. So, yeah, you could make consequentialist arguments, but just like Tom, you know, like people who argue with Stephen Kinsella. Well, clearly there has to be IP, because otherwise who's going to write a hit song or who's going to develop a new drug? And then Stephen can give his arguments as to why. So likewise here, to them, consequentialist arguments, if they think it's in violation of their moral principles, they don't care. But also they would argue against it, just like we, as, you know, anarcho-capitalist Rothbardians, a lot of times if you're talking to someone who likes National Review, he's going to say, well, first of all, you guys are crazy. Taxation isn't theft. But even putting that aside, if we did your crazy ideas next Thursday, you know, the Chinese communists would roll in with tanks and we'd all be taken over. So I think I just blew up your view, didn't I? And we would say, no, you didn't, with that consequentialist argument, because you're wrong.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But even so, every once in a while, somebody takes a second look and says, well, maybe. But yeah, but generally, that's right. That's not going to...
Well, what I do like is Gene Epstein's approach of saying to them, well, right now, nothing's stopping you in our current system from having a worker co-op, so why don't they do that? And, you know, in fairness, if they had come up with some sophisticated, well, the reason we don't do that is because of the tax code and blah, blah, blah. And so actually, I could respect that, you know, but
yeah,
they typically they don't say that. They give some bogus argument, and it's like, well, okay, so you're basically admitting it wouldn't work.
Yeah, or you're admitting you'd rather flap your gums about it but not actually do anything, which tends to be the case with a lot of political activists. Oh, they're happy to go out and hold a sign, but if it involves actually rolling up your sleeves and doing something, well, forget that. Let's talk about your money series for the Mises Institute that you've been doing. What's that all about?
Sure. So the name of it is Understanding Money Mechanics. I'll send you a link, Tom, for the show notes page. But if people just Google Robert Murphy, Understanding Money Mechanics, it'll certainly pop up. And it is a serial, not a breakfast serial, but a serial like a serial killer, a serial column being released every other week, just hitting a bunch of topics. It's like a crash course to give modern money mechanics. And so it's doing things we started out with just, what is money? What's the function of coinage? So given that money exists, okay, but why would you stamp coins? Does the state have to do that? Or give private examples. What's banking? Why would what does banking add to the equation once you already have money in place? Things like that. How does the Federal Reserve work? Just its basic structure. What's the Federal Open Market Committee? What is all this stuff? Those sorts of things. The tools, the standard monetary policy, open market operations. How has the Fed changed since the 2008 crisis? And then later, I'm going to get into objections, things like, Scott Sumner has said, that they should be doing NGDP targeting, not what they're currently doing, or the modern MMT folks, or, hey, didn't you guys worry about hyperinflation? That didn't happen, huh? So I'm going to go through a bunch of objections. Also, too, what I'm looking forward to is there's an objection along the lines of the standard textbook economist explanation of how the central bank buys assets and that adds reserves. Then the commercial banks go ahead and make new loans when they get those reserves inflowing. That gets the causality backwards. In the real world, customers apply for loans and banks make loans on, based on profitability. And then when that money gets deposited, that's the new reserves, right? So that they claim that people and most economists get things backwards. So I'm going to deal with that later. So it's, as I say, by the time the thing is done, it's going to be like a 130-page book or so, just given a great little introduction. If you want to know money and banking, like the quick theory, and then also some of the applications and details of the current structure, but also to grapple with some current controversies. So that the whole thing should be done in book form by the end of the year. But right now, we're releasing each new chapter as I do it every other week.
That is an amazing project. So you are like, you're like Woods was 10 years ago, I'll say. Right now, Woods is a lazy bum who does nothing. But in the old days,
once you get the Lifetime Achievement Award, what else is there?
I that's the problem with giving it to me so prematurely. I'm just going to slack off the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Because apparently, I've already done a lifetime's worth of stuff. So what's the point in doing it? Well, anyway, you know what did not last a lifetime was Bob Murphy Week. That absolutely flew by. And I think we should tell people, in case they have not heard, that the cruise, the Contra cruise that you and I have been doing for 5 years, there will not be one in 2021. We're not doing it in 2021. So you really got to join us this year for the roast of Dave Smith, which is going to be hysterical. Scott Horton's going to be with us. Phil Labonte of All That Remains. We will have an amazing time. So ContraCruise.com is the website. Bob and I are the hosts. And anybody who's been on it will tell you it is a fantastic time. You can see some video footage of it also over at ContraCruise.com. Bob, thanks so much for your time this week. You gave people a lot to chew on. I want to urge people to check out also your podcast, The Bob Murphy Show, over at BobMurphyShow.com. So now there is never any shortage of stuff to listen to. So go check that out, and we'll see you all next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.